From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, September the 19th, 2019. So I guess that makes it 9-19-19 or something like that. Wow.
Yeah, I wrote a check this morning, and that's exactly what it was.
A lot of palindromic dates recently. I think this one is the last one, though, in a string. All the ones that had ones in them. So 9-1-2, 9-1-0-1-9 was same forward and backward, and this is going to be the last one in the string, folks. So I hope you've enjoyed the last several dates here. Hey, anyway, we have a good show lined up for you today. Jeb Spaulding is my first guest. He's going to be talking about the future of the Vermont State Colleges. There's been a lot of consternation and concern about declining enrollments and other issues that stem mainly from that. In the second half hour, Don Turner is going to come by, and he also has a struggle on his hands to promote the idea that Vermont needs to shore up its core of first responders. This is an issue our former House Minority Leader has been working on for a while. He had an op-ed this week, and we wanted to get Don in here to get us updated on that issue of where are we going to get our volunteer firefighters and our ambulance crews and all the folks who we need in a tough moment, and if they're not there, that's a real problem. The later part of the show today, we're going to devote to something I think is happier than maybe the first two topics, and that is apples. It's apple season here in Vermont. Family and I were out at an orchard on Sunday, and in fact, we're going to have the owner of that orchard, the proprietor, Dan Baer. He's with the Peck Farm Orchard in East Montpelier. It's a new enterprise. They started planting their apple trees several years ago. My wife says they have small trees but big apples. That was kind of an interesting way to put it. And we'll be talking to Dan Baer as well as Terry Bradshaw. I don't think any relation to the NFL, former NFL quarterback, but he is with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. He's their apple expert, so we'll be hearing some overall about the apple season as well as getting maybe a narrower focused picture of the situation from a single orchardist, Dan Baer. So good show lineup, I think, for you this morning, and I want to start right in with Jeb Spaulding, who was kind enough to hurry over to the studio this morning. Good morning, Jeb.
Dave, nice to be here.
And thank you for getting here. Hey, so the state college system came out with a new statement yesterday. Why don't you tell us what you said?
Well, the Board of Trustees had a regularly scheduled meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, and it wanted to make clear that there were some rumors going around that were not accurate. And the rumor basically was that there was a decision that's been made to close the Linden campus of Northern Vermont University. And, you know, that's not good for the students that are there. It's not good for recruiting. Our schedule in terms of dealing with the white paper that laid out the challenges was to bring any recommendations for board action to the board in December. But this rumor was just rampant and causing a lot of consternation and worry. So the trustees spent about 2 days looking at all the different things and wanted to make it clear that while the challenges are real, and I would phrase it just a little bit differently, Dave, than you did in the beginning, a big challenge of declining enrollments. Sometimes that's true. What's really accurate is there's a big decline in the number of traditional students. It doesn't always mean that there is a corresponding decrease in enrollment. So just as an example, you know, there's been a 25% decline in the numbers of seniors in high school. And that's your traditional customer base for a Northern Vermont University or Castleton, let's say, or even a Vermont Technical College. But, you know, the enrollment in Castleton since the peak in 2009 was down like 1% through last year, which is amazing. And they had the largest incoming class, I believe, they've ever had this past, couple weeks ago. So, you know, the enrollment is okay, but it means that you have to make real adjustments in what you're providing in order to actually deal with the smaller traditional customer base and offer programming to the rest of the folks that haven't been going in the past. So, you know, sometimes it's enrollment, and the enrollment at Linden had slipped somewhat. Mm-hmm. When we looked at, you know, what we should do in the northern part of the state a couple of years ago, it's actually 3 years ago right about now that the decision was made to unify Johnson and Linden into Northern Vermont University. And that was a pretty innovative big move. And we just finished this past May, the first year of actual unification of, you know, the first year of Northern Vermont University. And we're very excited about the prospects ahead. Applications are up significantly for the year we're in right now. And, you know, yet the rumor was out there, and, you know, maybe it was partly me in saying, hey, look, we got some big challenges out there, and we aren't going to say no to no ideas right now. We want to get all the ideas on the table. And we've had over 200 of them that were submitted. Some of them said, hey, it looks like, you know, there are fewer students. Do you have to consolidate or close campuses? And while the board hadn't really even gotten together, this was their first chance to get together since the white paper was put out. And they had a situation where they needed to either, you know, say, well, that's no decision's been made, but it's still on the table. Or, you know, listen, we're telling you, we're going to, you know, deal with the challenges, but we're going to deal with it with the major campuses that we have. And that was the decision that was made. I certainly support that. And you know, we're going to, it doesn't mean that any colleges within the Vermont State Colleges system or outside can take their feet off the pedal and how we're going to deal with the big challenges that were outlined in our white paper, but we're going to do it in the context of the major campuses that we currently have.
So just to be clear, it sounds like there are going to be some announcements, or an announcement anyway, in December about decisions responding to the white paper and the responses you got to the white paper, et cetera. There's no chance that in December it'll be announced that the campus will close?
There's no chance.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I can't predict the future, but I mean, I can. I mean, unless something really happens, I mean, there is no plan, and I do not believe that there's any chance that that decision will be coming in December.
Okay.
So it's not on the table. I mean, that one, you know. So the process moves along. We said we're not going to say no to anything. Get your ideas in. Mm-hmm. But this mm-hmm. one was, you know, people thought there was a decision that had been made or likely to be made. And we needed to say, okay, we need to clarify the situation, and we hope we have.
Yeah, I know a couple of people who went to Linden, you know, quite well. And I must say they're big fans of the institution, and they were pretty worried. So I'm sure they're going to take some solace from.
Well, we were up in, you know, the process has moved pretty fast. I think today's Thursday, right?
Yeah.
Last Thursday, we were on the Linden campus, and there must have been, I don't know how many hundred of people that were there. They were very concerned and very passionate about, you know, how important the institution is to them individually. Mm-hmm. There were business people there that made clear that, you know, the economic foundation of the Northeast Kingdom was Northern Vermont University Linden, and this would be a major blow. There were plenty of students that were there that say we're not residential students, we commute here.
Yeah.
And if we didn't have this campus, we wouldn't have access to a comprehensive college, a full college.
Right, right.
And you know, there were select board members and all kinds of people talking about how important the institution was. And
where did this rumor get started? Do you have any idea?
Well, I don't really know. I think one, the white paper lays out some pretty serious challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you know, I mean, the chancellor said, hey, we're entertaining all ideas, you know, even consolidations or closures can't be taken off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told, Dave, whether this is true or not, by somebody that has had a long experience, that over the years, the idea of a closure on Linden has come up, you know, on multiple occasions. So there's a higher level of sensitivity that, hey, if somebody is going to go, it's probably us. And I can understand why people would think that, and I'm glad we could clarify the situation for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the biggest issue I think that I see for Vermonters and others too is the issue of affordability. Can we afford to go to college? And that has an impact on recruitment and enrollment and retention in a big way.
Yeah. And, so the board voted in support of a. What was it, a 2.9% tuition increase?
For next year, yeah.
For next year.
Yeah, yeah.
And costs keep going up, and certainly tuitions of not just at the state colleges, but at colleges all over the place are climbing faster typically than the rate of inflation.
So some of the ideas that we have on the table
mm-hmm.
Include how to reduce the amount of time it takes for a student to get a degree. Can we get a bachelor's degree into 3 years? can we get a master's degree into 5 years instead of 4 plus 2? You know, and just as an example, I mean, you know, and I mentioned like doing, you know, expanding our repertoire to provide programming to students we didn't before. So one example is with Castleton University. Took over a program that was and expanded on a program that was run by Green Mountain College that closed, Killington Resort Management Program. Now it's the Castleton Resort Management Program. It's very exciting. It's off to a great start. That's a 3-year bachelor's degree program, and people actually, you know, work while they're getting their bachelor's degree. So it's more like a full time situation. I mean, there's some vacation time, but it's basically, you know, you're going to school, working, and getting your degree in 3 years. That's a big savings for people. We have multiple new apprenticeship programs through Vermont Tech and Community College of Vermont. Those students are working and getting their education at the same time. So, you know, we're looking for ways that we can actually lower the cost of going there. Vermont Tech has a new program with Global Foundries, where Global Foundries hires the students right out of high school and pays for their credits at Vermont Technical College, you know, pays the students to work. They just graduated from high school, go to work for Global Foundries, get a good pay, and Global Foundries pays for their education through Vermont Tech.
You know, that sounds like a pretty sweet deal.
It is a sweet deal. And you know, we need to be not just sort of saying, okay, we're going to work harder at doing what we've always done, but look for ways that we can do things differently. And as I just mentioned, with an eye on affordability. So another major effort that we're thinking about is, like, you know, really expending more efforts on low and no cost textbooks. There's a, you know, open educational resources is a term within the higher education industry. And, you know, if we can lower the cost of textbooks by a few $100 a year, that's meaningful savings for students. So
yeah, textbooks are pretty killer. I mean, my kids are out of that college age bracket right now, but I remember just being amazed at finding out that you know, one course textbook was like $150, and I just kind of concluded somebody's gouging here, you know.
Right. Well, they're increasingly it's a lot of it's digital, but there are ways where, and I think our faculty you know, have many of them have moved in that direction, but we're going to really kind of make a major effort to do as much as we can to use the open educational resources and drive down the cost to students. And I would say the early college is a major savings for students. And one thing you mentioned, Dave, I'm sorry to keep going on. I was striving quickly to get here.
You're full of vim and vigor this morning.
But I mean, there's a lot of scholarship assistance, and all of our colleges have significantly increased scholarship assistance. So, you know, a 2.9% tuition increase doesn't necessarily translate into a 2.9% increase in the tuition that students will be paying.
Yeah, understood. The 3-year bachelor degree fascinates me. I mean, in part because of the cost, right there. That's a 25% reduction in the cost of getting a degree, right? If you're only going 3 years instead of four, and if you were thinking about the housing costs that go along, you know, sometimes in a dorm, sometimes in an off-campus apartment or whatever. And the room, you know, not just the housing costs, but spending an extra year on campus eating pizza or something, you know.
Well, and then if you're in the workforce a year earlier, then you have that income
too,
as well.
So that is helpful. Does the 3-year degree in any of the majors where it would apply? And I can't imagine it applies in every major.
No, it does not.
Yeah, but in any of the majors where it would apply, does it rely on some early college in, you know, when you're still in high school, that dual enrollment program?
No, but the dual enrollment is another way to get a head start and lower your costs when you get there. And the 3-year degree program, this is a concept that's going out there that we're going to push. It doesn't apply all the time, and sometimes it means, you know, you won't be taking the summers off either.
Yeah, you know? That's right. And there are lots of gives and takes and pushes and pulls here, because then you don't have that income from a summer job, perhaps. Right. So that's something to consider as well. But it's an interesting and innovative idea, certainly. And you know, I know that some schools have had programs similar efforts to sort of incorporate work into the school. Northeastern University is famous for its co-op program, where you go to school and you work for a while, you go back to school, and kind of switch back. My brother actually did that way decades ago now, and he launched himself.
Did it work out well for him?
Yeah, he launched himself into an excellent career as a electrical engineer first, and then later getting into marketing in the computer industry, where he was able to actually parlay his electrical engineering knowledge into helping people understand, you know, explain the technical stuff to non-technical people, basically. Hmm. And so that. Hey, we have a caller on the line, Jim from Barrie. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call. I talked to you last time you were on about saving the bioscience program at BTC, and there was something I forgot to mention, which I think ties right into the next guest that's going to be on. I took my State of Vermont Firefighter 1 at BTC, sat right beside BTC students, but because I was through the fire academy and not through BTC, I got zero college credit for taking that course. The explanation was they don't pay enough to be a tuition student, whatever it was. But it would be a greater incentive for people to get involved in the fire service with all the training that comes on with it, the requirements, if they get college credit while they were doing it. So I just throw that out and see what your comments might be. I'll hang up.
Well, thanks, Jim.
I'm not familiar with that particular situation, Jim. I understand what you're saying and think I appreciate it, and we'll definitely look into it. I know that you know, we are trying hard with the program we do to provide credit. Almost all of the certificate programs that are through Community College now, Community College of Vermont now, do provide college credit, so that they're stackable. And you know, if you don't get all the way to a degree at any particular time, you can always build on it later. The one with fire science, I don't know what that situation is, and I will have to look into it.
Yeah, that is an interesting question, though. And Jeb, we just have a few minutes left here, and I wanted to just kind of get some concluding remarks from you to say, in general, I know you got 200 responses to this request for, here's our white paper about what the future might look like in different paths forward. And any real upshot, any real unified message that you got from the responses to the white paper?
Well, the first thing to emphasize is that there was really very little, if any, disagreement about what the forces are that are coming at us. And that, mm-hmm. you know, one is the demographics, the other is pricing issues. And, you know, in order to deal with the demographics, most colleges are cutting their prices. So, you know, the average discount off of tuition at the independent colleges these days is like up to 60 or 70%. That's a race to the bottom, but that's a challenge we face.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the question of affordability and sensitivity of customers, those are students and their families, to the prices is a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the technology and disruptive kind of technologies that are out there and new ways of doing things is another challenge. So, you know, we got agreement on the challenges, and we got ideas that are a lot of small ones that are like, if you did better marketing, or should you consolidate your marketing teams to do more 2 and 4 year credentials to sort of mid-sized stuff like 3 year degrees and things like that we talked to great big ones like, hey, why don't you consolidate the University of Vermont and the Vermont State Colleges, or we only need the University of Vermont and one college? I mean, we had all kinds of ideas come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, partially that and me as the chancellor saying, look, these are serious challenges and we have to face up to them. We're not taking any ideas off the table. We want to solicit everything we can. Was what stimulated the concern in Linden. And really glad that the trustees were able to use our first meeting. We hadn't really planned on addressing this issue at the September board meeting earlier this week, but with the concern that was out there. And as you mentioned, Dave, I mean, when there is that kind of doubt, it really can have a very negative and snowballing effect on confidence and enrollment. So mm-hmm. we needed to make sure that we took care of the situation right away and feel like we made the right decision.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think, important message to get out there, kind of a not dead yet kind of thing,
yeah.
where you do need to tell folks that, hey, if you come to this, if you sign up for this college as a graduating high school senior, or even as an adult student who wants to take some time and get a degree, We're going to still be there by the time you graduate anyway.
Yeah, and I just want to say for the listeners, Northern Vermont University is a success. We are saving in the millions of dollars annually on executive management costs. The faculty are working more and more together. Our marketing teams, you know, instead of having two marketing teams each doing one college, we have a bigger marketing team with two campuses. So I'm very excited about what the future. President Collins is committed to it. She's one of the most determined leaders I've ever worked with, and I'm confident in NVU.
All right. Well, there you go. 1 year in, NVU's looking good, and nobody's closing anything, at least this year.
No, we're not talking about this year. We are committed for the future.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, Jeb Spaulding, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it this morning, and lots of things you're dealing with, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Dave.
And we're going to take a brief break for some CBS News at the bottom of the hour, and then a couple words from sponsors. In the second half hour, we're going to be talking with Don Turner about the crisis among Vermont first responders. We'll be back, folks.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toton Code, fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back, and I want to introduce my next guest. Don Turner is a former minority leader in the Vermont House. He is the he's on the Milton Volunteer Fire Department. He's also the town manager in Milton. He wears a lot of hats. I believe he's a realtor as well. So there's all sorts of stuff to keep Don Turner busy. But I appreciate you, Don, taking a half hour out of your day to join me here on the Dave Graham Show to talk about a very important issue, which is the problem of recruitment for Vermont's volunteer fire departments, ambulance services, EMTs, and the whole gamut of first responders. Don, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Dave, thank you for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and your listeners. So I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this issue that is, you know, it's been part of my life, my entire adult life. And I love serving the community, and I know many of my colleagues do in the field, but it is a challenging issue these days, and I feel it's a crisis. I really do, and I know there's a lot of people talking about it, so I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk to your listeners about this very important issue.
I saw an op-ed that you wrote this week, and you list a bunch of Vermont communities that are facing this same issue, which range from, you know, St. Johnsbury to Cavendish and Proctorsville, talking about a possible merger of their first responder services back down in southern Vermont, really all over the place. I think you mentioned that you, as I said, you were a member of the Milton Volunteer Fire Department. You've been chief there, is that right?
Yeah, I was the fire chief here in Milton for 15 years, Dave.
Yep.
I also was chief of the EMS, of the rescue squad, for 10 of those years, the last 10 years.
Yep.
So I had about 100 volunteers that worked with me, to provide these services to our community and neighboring communities. And we're fortunate in Milton. We have a very service-oriented community, and it's growing. But we still face the problem that all these other communities are, that you know, the younger people are moving and leaving.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bedroom community. I mean, that term you don't hear often these days, but
yep.
You know, most of the people in Milton work outside of Milton. So
right.
we are challenged like every other community with having staff here during the day or people that can respond to these calls. And, you know, what scares me the most is, you know, having been in that role for that long. And as I said, I joined the fire department when I was 17. It's been a very important part of my life the entire time, is when people call, they expect somebody to show up. And you know, there are nights that I laid in bed many times saying, boy, I hope we got a crew tonight. Or I know we have a crew, but it's limited, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
I can't imagine these communities that there's nobody that's going to respond. I mean, what do we say to the person or the family member when they dial 911, and it takes 45 minutes before a neighboring agency to get to the emergency, and by then it's way too late. So that's what I want people in this state to start to see and understand, that, you know, there's a lot of talk about this, but this is real, and this is going to impact them should they have a time of need, and we don't want that to happen.
Yeah, that is clear. Now, here's an is it purely demographics? I mean, I just had Jeb Spalding in talking about, he's a chancellor of the state colleges, and the state colleges and other colleges have been struggling with the fact that they have fewer applicants and fewer enrollees in many instances. That's not always the case, and it's not the sole challenge that colleges face, but it's a big one on the list. And I wondered, Don, is that the issue here? Is it just fewer bodies?
I think that's a big part of it, Dave. I think there are fewer people that, you know, with the aging population, you know, that's an issue. Demographics is an issue. The other thing is the cost of living. I mean, people, you know, in the older, you know, a decade or so ago, it was, you know, maybe not both people were working. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Somebody, so, you know, there was people around during the day. You know, we had some housewives or house husbands that were around during the day.
Yeah.
And I don't like to use those terms, but I mean, those are old terms. We don't hear those many today, but stay-at-home parents. There's not so many of those today. And that's so that cost of living here, I think, is a factor.
Here's another question, another possible factor I wanted to ask you about, which is that it's become the norm. I mean, just something I've seen over the past 30 or so years. It's many, many employers across many industries these days. Basically, it used to be you'd go to work 40 hours a week, and there was a specific shift. You punched a clock at a manufacturing job, typically, and it was going to be an 8-to-4 kind of thing, or a 7:30-to-4 with a half-hour lunch break, et cetera, et cetera. These days, people are working, you know, into the evenings and the early mornings. They wake up, and the boss has been sending them emails since 4 a.m., and the emails don't stop from clients and so on until well into the evening. And so really, when you think about your work life these days, it's frequently 50 or 60 hours for the average person. That's got to put a lot of pressure on people and make them basically feel like they may not have time to do something like join a volunteer fire department.
I think that's a very, very important factor in what we're looking at. And I actually talk about that a little bit in my op-ed, Dave, and that when we talk about, you know, you have less time and the expectations for training is increased.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword because, you know, what we used to expect when I joined, you know, back in the early 80s, you know, I just had to take a 45-hour course and I was ready to roll.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was a fireman. Today, I mean, to be a firefighter one, it's 287 hours of training. You know, if you want to be a state certified firefighter one, that's what is expected. I can remember I wasn't on the ambulance when I first joined. When I became chief, I did take the class because I, as a leader, felt that it was important for me to drive the ambulance and take care of patients and go to the hospital to understand what my crews were doing.
Yep.
And to become an EMT is 190, 200 hours. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So if you're working 50 or 60 hours a week and you didn't join when you were younger because you didn't have time or you didn't realize you were interested in that.
Yep.
Once you're in life and working, how do you add those hours on top of your work hours, your family hours, you need some downtime. So,
yep.
You know, it's a complication. So your point is a good point. And I do talk on, you know, the increased expectations or, you know, for training and so on the people that want to do this. So it's a challenge. And again, I don't want to put people out there serving their communities that are not trained, because there's nothing worse than that. I think that when a resident in probably in their worst possible point in their life, because if they're calling 911, they're not having a good day.
No.
You want to send somebody who can help them through this situation.
Yes, absolutely.
And then somebody that doesn't know what to do or actually makes it worse by doing something wrong. So I'm not advocating for, you know, minimizing training or anything like that. So I just want to be clear. It's just when you put those two things together, it makes it very difficult for people to join and become a volunteer in these services in our communities. Milton's a bigger community. We've been fortunate. I was fortunate as chief I've always had a roster over 30, 35 people. I had 50 on the rescue, you know, so I was fortunate. And we worked constantly, though, on recruiting people and retaining people. We started paying stipends for people to come to calls, and we did training and continuing ed. You know, so we were doing things. We were recognizing people for services that they performed, recognizing them for their efforts and awarding somebody Member of the Year and, you know, things like that. Have to recognize people because they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it for the good of the community.
Yeah. Although it also does look good on a resume, I would imagine. If you go into a job interview and you talk about, I'm a volunteer firefighter or an EMT crew member, I think that if I'm the employer, I mean, maybe it cuts both ways, because on the one hand, I might worry about, are you going to suddenly have to jump up in from your desk in the middle of a project or something? Yeah. But on the other hand, it tells me that this person is stable and is committed to their community, and is really typically a good person, basically, right?
Yeah. No, I always and when people are applying for jobs, you know, for me when I was in the private sector and even today at the town, I definitely give them I definitely give it a second look.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's important when you're willing to give of yourself to do these types of things. And what we've found, too, over the years, is these are a lot of, you know, longtime families that have been involved in this stuff, and they give a lot. You know,
yeah.
I think of the Clark family over in Jericho, and I like to speak. They're my friends. You know, Randy Sr. was the fire chief forever. Clark Truck Center essentially shuts down when they have a fire in Underhill at Jericho because half the people that work for them are on the fire department.
Yeah.
You know, so they give a lot.
Yeah.
They give a lot. And even my own family, my sister was an EMT. Both my sisters were EMTs. You know, I've been in the fire forever. You know, my kids, my daughter was an EMT. My nieces are EMTs and firefighters. So, you know, it's a family thing once you get people involved. And that's, you know, that's what has kept it going for all these years. And I think it will still help us go further. But we can't just turn a blind eye to what's happening. You know, it's the demographics, people moving out of certain parts of the state. Chittenden County, where Milton, you know, we're fortunate. We're seeing still growth. Milton's growing, and so is most of Chittenden County. But we aren't attracting the same people to these services.
So let me ask you this. I wonder about this kind of the opportunities here for people who live in communities that have full-time professional services. Now, for example, I'm imagining somebody who lives in Burlington and looks at the scene there and says, we got a fire department, we have a police department, we have EMTs all on staff with the city, and we'll talk more about is there a need for more professionalism here in this realm of Vermont's life. But I wanted to ask first about, should somebody say you're 28 years old, you're living in Burlington, you're saying, I'd like to do something to give to my community, I guess this isn't really open to me because we have professional staff doing all this stuff in Burlington, should that person consider Milton or Jericho or one of the outlying
towns. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And we've taken advantage, even in Milton, you know, our proximity to UVM and St. Michael's College, who have these programs for, you know, training these kids that come from all over the country to go to school, in those schools, and they get involved in these EMS programs. They come. I mean, that's what kept Milton Rescue when I was chief afloat.
Wow.
I had a group. I kept, you know, we would go to UVM and St. Mike's and, you know, basically beg them to come to Milton. And once we got them here, we'd work with them, and they'd bring their friends, you know, other kids that were interested,
yep,
and they were running shifts for us. So that was huge. And it was good for them, Dave, because they were going into the medical career, and they were getting this experience on a pretty busy department here in Milton. We run over almost a thousand calls on EMS annually.
Wow.
And what was great for me as the chief is when they moved on and graduated, to write a nice letter of reference for them and how much good they had done for our community. So it's a great experience and a great opportunity for those people that you're talking about that may live in areas that have career members, career firefighters, career EMTs, to serve if they want to be in those fields. So absolutely.
Now, here's a real practical question for you. A lot of Vermonters like to come home in the evening after work and perhaps head for the beer shelf in the fridge and render themselves unfit to drive, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Or light up a doobie, you know? I mean, that's another activity that happens a lot in the evenings. And obviously, you don't, you know, if you're unfit to drive, you can't respond to an EMS call, right? And are there days off in this realm, or is it, are you 24/7, or what's the deal there?
So you, as a member of Milton Fire or Milton Rescue, are committing to come whenever you're available and capable.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are on all the time.
Yep.
And I live my life, most of my adult life, is I didn't go home and have that beer because I never knew if I was going to get called out.
Right.
Not that it was, I didn't need to do that, and I loved what I was doing. So it didn't bother me. But you are always on call. That's what the deal is.
Okay.
And, you know, and people would say, well, you know, why does your wife drive and you drive to a birthday party? Well, I may have to go to a fire call, so I got to be able to go, you know, things like that. The number of events, the number of things I didn't get to go to because I had made a commitment to do this. You know, I missed my youngest daughter's first communion because I was at a call.
Yeah, wow.
I'm still paying that. My wife is still mad about that. And my daughter's 23. So that's the one thing I hear about generally a lot is, well, you weren't even at that. And I said, yes, she's right. So there's a lot of sacrifices that people give up. And, you know, I have, but it's a choice that I'm proud of, and I'm happy that I'm still part of it. And I'll probably be part of it until I can't actually get there anymore.
Right.
Because it is so important to help our communities.
But I mean, let me push this a little farther because I think it's actually interesting, and it may be. So you have a crew of 35 in Milton, let's say, do you think it would help recruitment if you were able to say to somebody, "Hey, by the way, you know, two days a month, you're free and clear. You don't have to respond to the calls," and then if that person wants to, you know, go to a party or something and have a couple, or even have a couple at home. That night, they're not worried about being called out. Would that help with the recruiting, or is that just a dumb idea?
No, I don't think that's a bad thing. And I know some departments, one of our neighboring departments went to where they had designated crews, you know, that they were on. And I want to clarify in that you're always on call.
Yeah.
But we all know that, you know, you go out to dinner and you have a drink or two. As an officer, I would let the other officers know, hey, I'm not in town, and you know, I'm down for dinner. I'm not going to be available until tomorrow or whatever.
Yep.
So it's not like we couldn't do that. And we had, you know, I had coordinated, and we had set up duty officers, so we had the opportunity and the leadership level to go and enjoy events and so on.
Yeah,
you're policing yourself in the fact that you know the expectation.
Right.
If you go out and have a drink, or you go home and have whatever you're going to do, and you're not fit, it's up to you not to come, and we'll have, you know, we had enough people where we could sustain that. But there are many places that's not the case.
Got it. Okay.
So I just want to make sure it's clear, but it's a choice. You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a choice that when we're in this, we do. My niece's husband's a fireman in Virgins, and, you know, they are in the same boat. Everybody's the same. You know, we have a core group of people, and, you know, we need more. And
got it.
It's,
let's talk about solutions, Don. I see in your piece that you mentioned financial woes faced by the Williamstown Fire Department caused them to consider charging for some fire department services, with the funds going to give volunteer firefighters a $1,000 property tax deduction. And this is an interesting idea. Has that been adopted in Williamstown, or are other towns considering it?
Well, actually, I put that in there because Milton, we have a billing. When I was during my tenure as chief, we instituted a billing policy, and then money goes back into the general fund to help cover costs of the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically every insurance, essentially what it is every insurance policy, homeowners insurance, business insurance, has a fire department charge built into the policy. So if you need the services, that you can bill the insurance company and they will pay. It's usually, you know, $500 to $1,000 is what the limit is.
Mm-hmm.
But every policy has it, but most places don't bill, so the insurance companies never pay that out.
Yeah.
So I did a bunch of research, and as the fire chief, I brought it to the select board in Milton, and they adopted that policy where we bill. We bill for, you know, if there's a structured fire and we have a major time commitment. So we'll build a 500 or 1,000, whatever the policy amount is.
Yeah.
We don't seek money over and above the policy amount from the resident. They've already had a loss. It's a challenge for them. You know, there's a lot of, you know, we don't want to get into that. They're paying their taxes, but there is a cost to these services. And I think it's important that there is money that comes back into the community for providing these types of services. We haven't really had any people, no real issues with it. We also bill for hazardous material incidents, car accidents, things like that. And again, it's in your auto policy to pay for this service. So why wouldn't you do it? So that's one of the things that we have done here in town. So I think it's a good idea, and I think you have to do it. So that's one thing that could be done. Another thing that could be done is looking at more regional-based operations. You know, we've had pride in Vermont, and there's probably almost a fire department in most communities around the state, or an EMS in many areas, and that is working out regional agreements, you know, that you strategically place a station or keep a station open in one community or not another or whatever, as long as you have response. That's going to be a harder thing. You know, these agencies are so based, community-based operations that I think it would be positive, but I want to definitely research it because it could become a negative. In that, you know, I have pride in Milton and I want to serve Milton, but does that mean I want to serve Essex and Colchester and Georgia and all that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm already giving my time, but I'm giving my time to my neighbors.
Yeah, and there is a limit to anybody. You said everybody needs a little downtime occasionally.
Exactly.
And if you're signed up with multiple busy EMS or fire departments, you are really stretching yourself. So,
yeah, hey, so it's Don, almost like a Band-Aid. Yeah.
Don Turner, speaking of stretching yourself, we are about out of time for this segment of the Dave Graham Show, but I really appreciate you coming on this morning and reminding people of this problem and the search for solutions. It's a very important topic.
Well, Dave, I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for what you do, and I appreciate the invitation and look forward to coming back again sometime soon.
All righty. Going to take a brief break for some CBS News at the top of the hour, words from our sponsors, and then Talk Media News, and then we'll talk about it in the second hour of the show, Apples. Stay with us, folks.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tone Code, fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we continue into our second hour on this Thursday morning, September the 19th, 2019. And I think we have a new player coming into the game today from Talk Media News. Is it Doug Christian? Do I have that right?
You got it.
All righty. Thanks for joining us this morning. And Doug, are you new at Talk Media News or just new here?
No, I've been here for years. I'm a White House reporter, but I usually don't do the morning hits. What I usually do is a report from the White House. So
I got it.
Capitol Hill.
All right. So and the White House is always producing interesting stories these days. What's your top headline today?
Top headline has to be the whistleblower standoff between the DNI and Congress. Whistleblower had, who was a intelligence official, presented a, quote, urgent concern. That's a legal term. It's not just an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
To the IG or the Inspector General within the intelligence community. And the IG looked at that and said, yep, that is definitely an urgent concern. Now, this is, and then he, by law, presented that over to the DNI or the Director of National Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And by law, and that is Joseph McGuire. He's the acting Director of National Intelligence. He took over from Dan Coats. By law, this is not an opinion at this point. He is supposed to present that information to Congress. And McGuire refused to do so. He actually went to the Justice Department, which is actually outside of what the law specifies. The law says you shall present this to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't do that. He actually went to the Justice Department. The Justice Department gave some opinion about it being maybe not an urgent concern. Maybe it's this or maybe that. And here's the thing, and that is that the law specifies very clearly that this cannot be because of somebody's opinion, whether they like somebody, don't like somebody. It has to be an actual pressing matter. And this does, this means that it cannot be, let's say it's the president, which it seems that it is, involves the president.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be that he revealed classified information because he is the president and he can reveal classified information no matter what. He is the president.
Yeah.
It might be bad for the national security, but the law does not prohibit him from doing that. The reporting from WaPo or the Washington Post says that this involved a phone call to a foreign leader and it involved a promise. Ample speculation as to who the phone call was to and what the promise was. The thing is let's say the promise was to reveal means and methods of intelligence gathering, that would qualify as an urgent concern.
Yeah.
If it's just simply, we found out that Putin was behind the 2016 attacks on American election, no, that is not an urgent concern.
Yeah, so did the Justice Department say, hey, we don't think this is an urgent concern, or what? How did they respond to this?
In legalese. And, yeah, and now the Intel Committee has met at 9 a.m. to behind closed doors with the Intel Community's Inspector General. Whether or not they're going to get the information from him is an open debate, because he might turn around and say, yes, I affirm that this is in fact an urgent concern, and by law I presented this to the DNI. I am not legally responsible for presenting you with that information. That's the DNI that's supposed to do that.
Huh.
And so, I mean, people are pretty careful about these things. They aren't going, it's unlikely that he's going to present any kind of straight information. The thing is that House members within the Intelligence Committee might say, you know, try to confirm with him, was this about a phone call between the president and a foreign leader, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it'll be very interesting. Of course, we don't know how he's going to be responding, but he'll have to be very careful because he doesn't want to go beyond his purview.
And is this just the administration basically sticking its thumb in the eye of Congress again, or what is the motivation for not wanting to convey this information, which apparently, as you tell me, there is a law saying they shall do this, something that's basically must happen.
Of course, we can't ever read somebody's motivation. That's reading somebody's mind. That's mm-hmm. almost impossible.
Yep.
But we can say that it is that if we were to read the tea leaves here, the president attacks any news organization that reports anything negative about him.
Mm-hmm.
He has been silent about this on Twitter, that would indicate that he is gravely concerned about the reporting.
Wow. Yeah.
And,
so, but we don't know, we don't really have any good intel on which foreign leader, what was the content of the phone call? I guess a promise was made of some sort. I mean, is there any idea?
Well, there's speculation. There was a meeting, phone conversation that President Trump had with Vladimir Putin in Russia on July 31st because the whistleblower complaint came less than 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
That readout of that phone call was kind of odd because it talked about the White House readout was the president was talking about helping Russia with wildfires. It just seemed really weird to many people reading those readouts, like, what are you talking about?
Huh.
So
wow,
that's kind of what many people are thinking it might be.
Yep.
But again, we don't know. I mean, and it's really important to say we don't know. I mean, because we don't want to report something that we don't know what it is.
Right, right, yeah.
But we can say that it is, if Donald Trump were not gravely concerned about this, he would just go on the attack.
Yeah. Yeah,
he's not doing that.
That is maybe all of his previous attacks of the mainstream media. He might come to regret them because when he stops attacking, then that's really noticeable. Whoa, something's going on here. That's amazing.
That's exactly right. I mean, he's attacked Jay Powell last night, you know, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, calling him no guts, no sense, no vision, a terrible communicator. You know, here he is, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. I mean, he'll do anything if it achieves his ends politically.
Mm-hmm.
But here he is, I mean, is just silent.
Yeah. That's uncharacteristic.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
And so, I mean, I do feel that that's really all we really have to go on right now. And I do think that the Intel Committee is absolutely keen on finding out exactly what happened. Now, the acting director of the National Intelligence, acting DNI, is Joseph McGuire, is set to testify in a public hearing on September 26th. And unless this information comes out by a leak or some other means, which actually it might be unlikely that it comes out by a leak, even though Washington leaks everything eventually, you can be sure that he's going to be asked about that. And the reason I say I think it's unlikely that it will come out in a leak is because people, if this is that serious and that important, the last thing that anybody wants is for this thing to be mitigated by some sloppy behavior of somebody within the intelligence community.
Yeah, yeah. That obviously, ideally, you want this thing to be handled properly and carefully. You know, intelligence like this can be very, very sensitive. And I mean, is there a chance it'll never come out?
I don't think there's a chance it will never come out.
Yeah.
I do think that a lot has already come out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's put it this way. Some people know what the allegation is because we've got this much information so far, but people who know aren't saying much because they do not want to make that the story.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, they want to make sure, and let's put it this way, again, it's really important to put this in perspective. If this were simply revealing class deeply, let's say compartmentalized information, which is more secret than top secret information,
mm-hmm.
the president could do that.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, this has to be much more serious than that.
Wow. And where it may look bad for the president, and so that's another reason that he's not doing anything here.
That again seems to be
pure speculation.
What people are thinking,
yeah.
But again, it's really important to put aside speculation here,
yeah. Yeah.
And just simply say this is what we know and what we don't know.
Okay. Well, Doug Christian, I really appreciate you sharing this information with us this morning. I think it's something we're going to all have to be watching carefully and see what unfolds. Every Thursday in the latter hour of the program for at least several weeks to come, we'll see how long we keep coming up with fresh topics. The University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences has been in touch with us and asking to participate in this weekly program that we're launching on the Dave Graham Show. And they've got a whole range of different topics. We had them on sort of a couple weeks ago, it was when we were talking about sheep grazing at the Shelburne Vineyards to keep the grass growth and other growth down between the rows of grapes. Very interesting and fascinating conversation. And of course, a lot of Vermonters really love their living things, their agricultural crops and animals, and there are just tons of subjects in that realm of what's out there for flora and fauna, and sometimes human beings. I think one of the programs we're going to do in this series is going to concern the upcoming census. So there are a lot of topics that the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences delves into, and we're calling the series "Seeds to Society," and because there is that. That life element to it, and of course the social impacts of all this are very, very important as well. Today we're going to start out with a conversation about apples. And of course it's apple season in Vermont, and my wife and I and a couple of friends took a trip out to an orchard in East Montpelier that's only recently launched. I think they've been at it for just 60 years or so, and my wife was, her remark was the place had small trees but big apples. Both things I found to be true as well. And so I want to introduce my guests, two guests on this next segment of the Dave Graham Show. Terry Bradshaw is with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and he is a resident expert there on apples, and I believe grapes too. Maybe we'll get a little bit into grapes, but I want to really focus on apples first because, of course, this is the season for apples in Vermont. And Dan Bear, I said Doug Bear a little bit earlier when I was introducing all this before the break, and I was speaking previously with a Doug Christian from Talk Media News, so that's your daily brain cramp for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. But Dan Bear, I want to welcome you to the program. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us off. And you're not too far off. My younger brother's named Doug. So
okay. Maybe yeah. I had some family resemblance in mind or something. I'm not sure. But since I don't know Doug, probably not. So I can't use that as an excuse. Terry Bradshaw is in the studio here with us here at the WDEV in Waterbury. Thanks for making the trip down, Terry.
Thank you, Dave.
And so let me start with you, Dan. And I really am curious about your orchard operation over there in East Montpelier. Sibley Road is the location. You're welcoming members of the public to come in and pick their own apples, maybe take a hayride and or take a walk through your corn maze there. It's a beautiful spot, and I can't say enough about just kind of congratulations on getting it going. This is the Peck Farm Orchard, right?
Peck Farm Orchard, yeah. You know, we're on a family property here, and mm-hmm. the original settlers were the Pecks, and that's why it's the Peck Farm Orchard. We're just trying to, honor all the work they did sort of carving out a beautiful farm spot here in East Montpelier.
Yeah, and if you get enough pecks together, you have a bushel, right?
Right. Yeah, there's a little bit of math in there. It's still kind of early, so.
Okay, yeah. Well, now you got me curious. Do you know how many bushels or how many pecks are in a bushel?
Well, we do half pack bags, okay. And then we do peck bags.
Okay.
And you know, it's interesting because and Terry might be able to speak to this a little bit, but it's a combination of volume and weight. So we just fill these bags up, and they kind of go in half sizes, half pack, peck, and yep. Bushel is twice a peck, and they're like, you know, 5, 10, 20 pounds respectively, somewhere in there.
Okay, I see. Interesting. And we actually brought home a bag of your Honey Crisp apples the other day, and I must say they are really delicious. They're nice and crisp, as the name would imply, and a little on the tart side, and just real, you know, it's freshness in your hand and in your mouth. It's a beautiful thing.
So, yeah, truly.
Yeah. Hey, what other varieties of apples do you have there? I'm trying to remember.
We have a variety called Summer Mac. We have an old variety. It was my grandmother Ellen's favorite, called Wealthy. That's an interesting apple. You know, we're getting ready to have some Cortlands that are ripe, and Macowan, and a whole bunch of Liberties, which is a great all-around apple.
I think Macowan might be my favorite. I love when you get them with the pink insides. That's a real treat.
Oh, wow, yep. They're a little ways off, but we'll see you back here again soon.
Yeah. Let me broaden the scope here and ask Terry Bradshaw to weigh in. And Terry, my first question for you is, how is the Vermont apple crop going this year?
Yeah, as many people often know that we often talk about whether it's a good apple year or a bad apple year. The trees, when you look at them on the sides of the roads, often will tell you that. They'll either have a full crop or no crop, and this is one of those full crop years. So we're calling this a good apple year, but that's a little bit of a misnomer because orchards that manage their crop can't have a crop every other year. So typically they thin off the fruit in most years, but certainly in the heavier cropping years, so that you get a consistent crop. There haven't been any real problems frost-wise, minimal hail that's been reported. So this is what I would say on a per acre basis, and we could talk about that a little bit more later. It's I would say an average or slightly even above average crop, which in Vermont means about 500 bushels per acre. Used to mean about 800,000 bushels per year produced by the state.
Wow. Hey, I want to mention we are coming up fast on our bottom of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show for some CBS News, and we'll be heading there in just a moment. But then continue our conversation about apples afterward. But I wanted to also let you, Terry, maybe expound a bit here a little bit. Are there particular breeds that of apples, you know, or maybe that's not the right word. What is the right word when you compare, say, a Honey Crisp to a Cortland or a
Yeah, we call them, in science speak, we call them cultivars. In common speak, we call them varieties. So
right.
Cultivated variety.
Okay. I was thinking about dogs or something for a minute there.
They're similar.
Yeah.
Yeah, similar idea.
Yeah. So, we can talk about it after the break because that's fast coming up. I was going to ask you, are there particular cultivars or particular varieties that are doing really well this year? But I'll get an answer to that after we go to some CBS News in the bottom of the hour and then a couple words from our sponsors. We will be back, folks. Stay with us.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tone Code, fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And my guests are Terry Bradshaw, the apple and I guess grape expert at the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and Dan Baer of the Peck Farm Orchard in East Montpelier on the phone with us this morning. Dan said he couldn't take the time to drive to Waterbury because he's a busy man with his new orchard. Dan, you've been in operation, did I have the right 6 years?
Well, yeah, we planted 6 years ago, and uh-huh. These trees are what we call full dwarf trees. So they're a little quicker to begin
fruiting than a traditional tree that you might find in your backyard. So
I see.
We were able to start picking apples about 3 years ago, and last year and this year are actually a pretty good marketable crop.
Yeah, that is definitely marketable crop. As I say, I was over there this past weekend, and we were picking some beautiful apples off those little trees. Nice, big, as my wife was saying, small trees, big apples. That's really something. So these trees are actually fully grown now?
No, they aren't. You know, it's interesting, and Terry might have some more experience talking about this, but, you know, we prune them very differently. We're pretty aggressive about pruning out the branches in the springtime,
mm-hmm.
and that helps these dwarf trees to focus more energy into fruit production. That's why, you're seeing all those apples on that teeny little stick and the reason why they're so big. And it's also the reason why each tree is, it's supported by a trellis system. So when people come out, they're not going to see a traditional orchard they're used to, more like a hallway of apples, so to speak.
Yeah, it really is amazing, and it does feel that way because you the way you plant in rows, and I've seen other orchards do this too. I guess it's the technique, but you have a nice passageway between the rows of apple trees for folks to get in there. The only thing is, you know, people might want to bring their pet giraffe to get some of the nice ones way up high there.
Yeah. We'll have some pickers for later season apple picking at the top there.
Yeah, because, we were eyeing some of those, and it was, I can't quite reach them, so... Isn't there an Aesop's fable about not being able to? But I'm not buying that. It can't be sour fruit up there. It's got to be more delicious apples. So anyway, tell me a little bit about the sort of economics here, if you don't mind. Imagined yourself as an orchardist as of 6 years ago, and significant capital outlay, or not as much as some other agricultural pursuits, or where does it fit in that picture?
It's pretty significant up front, especially with the trellis system. You know, each mm-hmm. individual piece doesn't necessarily cost a lot, but, we're buying a piece of conduit for each tree, and we have somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 trees out there. So when you start to add up all these smaller costs, the cost of fencing, and then, of course, the cost of the trees, it's pretty significant up
yep.
front, and... it's something that, the economists there at UVM have done some pretty good work studying and figuring out for those of us who are a little more farm-minded.
Yeah, it's a going concern. You can make this work economically. Is that right?
I think once we get to this point, things look pretty good. We're just at the mercy of, the weather
from
a year-to-year basis and pests.
Uh-huh.
That was a little difficult for us up front. We had some challenges with some disease that came in and some freeze damage and some mouse damage. But fortunately, Terry was able to come down and help us sort of figure that out and recover in a little more graceful way than I might otherwise have.
Yeah, well, that's good. And I want to talk with Terry a little bit about it. But I had one more question for you, which you mentioned conduit connecting the trees. Talk to us about that. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going, huh, what's that?
Yeah, so, if you think of it kind of more, I guess, like a vineyard, a trellised grape vineyard, we have these posts that are driven into the ground, and then there's a high tensile wire on the top,
mm-hmm.
Some wood posts about 30, 40 feet apart, and then the trees are planted anywhere from 3 to 5 feet apart, and in the rows. So if you can imagine, they're pretty close together. It's like a wall of trees.
Yep.
And then they are tied, each one of them is individually hand-tied to a piece of 12-foot metal conduit that we sort of stick in the ground and then attach to that very tall wire that's at the top.
Yeah.
So it's pretty solid, and it's a good system for keeping the tree supported because, as you notice, they're teeny little trees, maybe not even some of them 2 inches across, with anywhere from 40 to 60 pounds of fruit on them. So
yeah,
need that support.
That would get a little top heavy without some support. So I get what you're... I just imagined for a moment, maybe by conduit you meant there was some kind of a watering system connected there or something like that. Do you water? How does that work? Tell me about the sort of that level of maintenance there.
Yeah, so we do drip irrigation, and this year I didn't have to. You know, a lot of farmers and had a really tough go of it this spring. We've got decent drainage, and we had so much rain that I didn't have to do it this year. Last year, we absolutely maintained our drip irrigation, which is a really more efficient way of sort of directing a stream of water right at the base of the tree.
Yeah, yeah, and that a lot of things to think about in this sort of thing. I think folks who go out and visit an orchard and have a fun afternoon might not really be reflecting on all of the background work that goes into creating this environment. And you know, it's a fun outing. I see a lot of families with kids in particular going out picking apples and so on and so forth. And of course, you guys add to the mix a couple of, you know, family style entertainments with your hayride and your and then in the you also have the corn maze. So I understand you have a neighboring farmer who helps you out with the corn maze. Is that right?
Yeah, we work we lease our fields to Fairmont Farms of East Montpelier, and they've just been really great about being able to plant a variety of corn that they pick rather than chop. So we're able to keep the corn maze up a lot later than we might otherwise. And it's a fun little corn maze. It's designed to be family friendly, not stressful, and it's always got a rotating theme. And you know, we're just trying to make the place here, you know, a place for families to come, spend some time together, put the phone away, you know, just enjoy the beautiful weather and the scenery and the apples.
Sure. Hey, Terry Bradshaw, how many orchards are there in Vermont, do you know?
Well, that depends on how you count them. The USDA statistics count well over 100, but realistically, the bulk of the industry is comprised of about maybe 40 orchards, and they're two very different types of orchards. We have what remains of our wholesale market. So Vermont used to be known for milk, maple, and apples as far as crops that were exported out of the state. Mm-hmm. And there's still probably a half dozen, maybe eight orchards that are, 50 to 200 or plus acres that are selling the vast majority of the fruit. And then the rest, there may be 20 or 30, maybe a few more, smaller orchards that are doing more of a direct retail, pick your own, like Dan's Orchard. So it's kind of a split market that's showing really the new times in terms of the market that people are selling apples into. Prior to, especially the 1990s, but even continuing into now, you could make a living off of 20 acres of apples and put them on a truck and ship them through the cooperative packing house and, you know, get your check in April, and it was enough to live for the year. And those days are pretty much long gone, at least as far as that small acreage. And it's getting more and more difficult for the large wholesale orchards as well. We have a lot more other fruit to face, to market against, not just other varieties, but there are many other varieties that are not grown in Vermont, other production regions, Southern Hemisphere shipping fruit that didn't happen before the 1980s. And then, of course, you've got all the other fruit that are in the supermarket that are competing with them. So that market's a little bit different. So we've seen a real contraction in acreage total, but I wouldn't say really in the number of orchards that much.
I see. Huh. And are most orchardists who are doing this, it is a full-time thing for them? I mean, that's their, it's not like a sideline where they're also milking cows or whatever.
I don't know. Let me think. I don't know of any that are still milking cows and running an orchard. There were a few, but those, usually you kind of separated those out 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Most of the orchards, I would say, are a single operation, maybe would be tied into some other crops, maybe into maple. And oftentimes somebody in the family is still working off the farm, which is pretty common in farming in general.
Yeah.
But once you get up above really 10 acres, that's a full-time job.
Wow. Huh. That's interesting to me. And I gather there are different things to do at different times of year. Maybe Dan Baer, tell us a little bit about your experience with that. Your season, is there any downtime in the winter? There must be, right?
There absolutely is. I mean, we're still cleaning up the orchard in November. Things slow down, kind of end of October. And then, you know, I actually go into sugaring and a little bit of timber work. But then the spring comes around and we're pruning. And then kind of the real busy season for all the upfront work, the stuff that people don't see is that sort of early spring before leaves start to come onto the trees. That's when we're really focusing on, you know, pruning and getting these trees ready, assessing winter damage and kind of doing our best work to ensure that we have a good crop in the fall.
Terry Bradshaw of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, you are their apple expert, and I think you also delve into grapes. And since I mentioned the Shelburne Vineyards, I just thought, how's the grape crop this year? I should ask you.
Yeah, this is one of those years. Vermont's grape crop has gone from zero to 175. I'll explain that in about 20 years. So about 20 years ago, we had essentially no grapes, commercially grown grapes, 20 some odd years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have about, the number we use is about 175 acres of grapes.
Wow.
I say it's our second most valuable fruit crop. I may be off on that, but I think it may be correct. Apples being our most valuable, and that's because grapes can be made into wine.
Yep.
And that really multiplies the value substantially. So my back of the envelope math is we have about a $4 million wine industry that people don't realize necessarily, but it's getting more and more press, not just locally, but even regionally, and certainly in, you know, there's certain folks down in New York City who are tied in with the Times and some of the restaurants who are starting to catch on to Vermont wine.
Wow.
So it's growing.
That's interesting. I used to think of wine as more of a warm weather crop. Is this being helped by climate change?
Yeah, that's a question we get all the time. It's a trick question, actually. I ask students, you know, why can we grow grapes now when we couldn't 20 years ago?
Yeah.
And they always say climate change. And that's, if climate change actually moved everything up exactly 10 degrees, then that would allow us to grow the grapes that, you know, central New York can. But it doesn't. It makes things more erratic.
Huh.
So it has made things more difficult. Really, what's allowed things to happen in terms of increasing grape production is the breeding of cold climate or cold hardy grapes, mostly in Minnesota and Wisconsin by both public and private breeders. That concerted effort to make to breed varieties that can withstand the cold and still make pretty good wine.
Got a caller on the line. Forbes from Corinth is with us. Good morning, Forbes.
Hi. How are you?
Hi, Forbes.
Hi. How you doing?
It's been a few years.
Yeah, it sure has. I'm part of that history, I guess. When I first started, we went with semi-dwarf. And in an acre with semi-dwarf, you could put about 109 trees in. With the new concepts, more or less the Esplanade, you can get up to 400 per acre.
Wow.
And, of course, land is pretty expensive, so the type of orchard that you went to and picked at is the new and coming orchard.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's I've seen the transitions. The semi-dwarf, the average life of the tree was 25 years. So every 5 years you had to put in about 25% of your existing trees to replace them. And if you didn't, they play out.
Yeah. How long do these dwarf trees last, Terry?
You know, we haven't had them in the ground for 25 years here yet.
Yeah.
Across the lake in New York, there's been a fair amount of work done by Cornell to really push this new system. And they, I would say, have the oldest of these, what we call tall spindle orchards.
Mm-hmm.
There's one over there planted maybe 2005, so it's approaching 15 years.
I see.
And it's fully producing. I suspect after about 20 years that people will want to plant the next new variety that's going to fetch a higher value.
Wow. So, Forbes, are you having a good year in your orchard?
Yes. It's of course, my trees now are up too high.
Uh-huh.
So it precludes a U-pick, which I always had.
Yeah.
And, of course, apples had dropped, the time I kind of backed out of it, they dropped down to like 42 cents a pound.
Hmm.
And now they're up at a dollar a pound.
That's a little healthier.
Or better.
Yeah.
So, but if you let your orchard go because it costs you more to grow apples than you could get, then you'd be way behind as far as regenerating.
Wow.
So it's a whole new world out there. It
All right. Well, Forbes, I thank you for the call. I didn't realize you were an orchardist. I know you are a not infrequent caller to the Dave Graham Show, and so we learn something new every day. That's great.
Right. I also have a winery right in town here now.
Wow. So you must be in touch with Terry fairly often, because since he's apple and grape pomology, I think, is the topic. Is that right, Terry?
Well, over the years, I guess. My son knows him quite well.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. Thanks again, Forbes. Thank you. Chatting with you. And Dan Baer, have you considered grapes at all?
No, you know, honestly, the time it takes for me to get everything else done around the farm, the 2 months that I sit here to sell apples, I don't want to extend the season quite yet. But we have planted a third of our orchard. It is planted to hard cider varietals or cultivars. Mm-hmm. And so these are apples that you really probably wouldn't want to even take a bite out of, similar to a wine grape. They're bred and selected for hard cider production.
I see. And are you planning a hard cider? What is that, a distillery, or what do you call a production facility for hard cider?
Yeah, I mean, well, so you could call it a cidery or a winery.
Yep.
We're in the process of the permitting process right now, and hopefully it's in the hands of the federal government right now. We'll see what they think, and we'll go from there.
All right. Well, I'm expecting to see you on the store shelves anytime now, the Peck Farm Hard Cider. And might pick up a sample, so that's great. I wish you luck with that. Hey, we are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and I want to thank my guests very much, Terry Bradshaw of the College of Arts and Science, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont, and also Dan Baer of the Peck Farm Orchard in East Montpelier. I wish you a good balance of the apple season this year, both of you gentlemen, and thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty, folks. That's about it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. I've got a show coming up tomorrow devoted entirely to climate change. It's the first day of this big climate change action around the world, and so we're going to be talking about different aspects of that issue. Tune in then, and meanwhile, stay with us for Bill Sayre's Common Sense Radio Show and the Midday News Service here, Pittsquatrone, later in the afternoon. Have a great day, everybody.